Moving on now and looking back, I guess you could say it's Back to the Future. 15 years ago this week, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground on a reef in pristine Alaskan waters, spilling millions of gallons of oil and causing untold damage. Joining me now to talk about the spill and how the environmental and how the environment and the people involved here have been affected, and how are they recovering? Have they recovered? What's the state of that recovery? Chief Bryce, he's program manager of Exxon Valdez Studies at the Auk Bay Laboratory of the National Marine Fisheries Service. That's part of NOAA, based in Juneau. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rice.
Hi, you're welcome.
Hi. Mary Beth Holloman is the author of The Heart of the Sound, An Alaskan Paradise Found and Nearly Lost. That's just out from University of Utah Press. She's also adjunct professor at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Welcome. Nancy Bird is president of the Prince William Sound Science Center and director of the Oil Spill Recovery Institute of Cordova, Alaska. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mary Beth, can you describe for us what it was like to be there when that happened, that's the oil spill, the sights, the sounds? How did it affect you?
Well, I was in Anchorage when I got the news. That's where I was living. And I was awakened with the question from my husband, guess where the biggest oil spill in U.S. history is? And Prince William Sound was the reason that I moved to Alaska, really, in 1986, after working there for that first summer. So at first I was in complete denial. I was fairly naive, as I'm sure Nancy and others in Cordova weren't, that such an event could even happen in the Sound, and that we could be so unprepared. So there was this denial, there was this feeling of desperation also on the heels of that to do something about it. And so I, like thousands of other people from around the country, were compelled to see what we could do to fix what we had broken here. And soon after that, I went to Valdez and got out on the water, got to see what the spill looked like, and the denial quickly faded at that point. But at first, it was very unclear what, if anything, I could, as a volunteer, do. Later, I did clean oiled otters in Seward. I went to Homer and tried to capture oiled birds. I ended up on Perry Island for a couple weeks on a witness program, just desperately trying to figure out something that could be done.
And how today, if we were to go there 15 years later, would we still see remnants of the oil spill?
If you knew where to look and how to look at it. You know, because I knew the sound before the spill, now when I go out there, I can tell where there are fewer sea otters or harbor seals. And even sometimes that the wildlife seems more reticent to be around me after all of the cleanup efforts and all of the human activity out there. And also, you can still find oil on beaches, as Dr. Rice well knows, and it's just right under the surface. My husband, Rick Steiner, was out there on March 11th this month and brought back some oil, and it's still the same viscosity, the same fumes as that first summer.
Dr. Rice, describe it for us. What would we see if we went there today?
Well, if you weren't from there, you probably wouldn't find very much. The Sound definitely has recovered an awful lot since 1989. But having said that, if you know where to look and how to look, you can easily find it. It's just 5-6 centimeters underneath the surface, and it's in quite a few different places. It's not just in one spot.
Now, Exxon has said that the reason, the fact that you can still find the oil there, shows that it has not affected the environment. Has not been what is there is a deleterious effect. How do you react to that?
Well, it's true that the material that was on the surface and that sort of stuff has disappeared. The easy stuff to clean up by nature has disappeared, but what is still there is still causing some effects. Sea otter populations in some parts of the Sound, like Herring Bay, have not recovered. They still show symptoms of being exposed to oil because of an elevated enzyme that reacts to oil. And we put out sampling devices on the surface, and we can still detect oil that's coming from oil patches.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about the 15th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Is there one segment of wildlife or of the ecosystem there that has not recovered as well as the other?
Yeah, the intertidal zone is not quite the same as it was, and that's where the oil still remains, where it came ashore. And if you're an animal or a plant that lives there or resides there or forages there, then you're likely still to have some level of exposure and still have some sort of symptoms. Now, the oil that's there is not causing acute mortalities like it did in 1989, so you don't see carcasses and whatnot, but you do see the lack of recovery of some animals. Like in Herring Bay, there are 35, 38 carcasses taken out of there in 1989, but there are no animals, no sea otters residing there today, 15 years after the spill.
Nancy Bird, when it happened, was this really a shocking event to think that this could happen, given that there were oil tankers going around there and oil being piped and shipped out of there?
It was a very shocking event. I think that Cordovans, while we, being a commercial fishing town of about 2,500, we use Prince William Sound as our main source of revenue for commercial fishing and other enjoyment of the sound. So we were more aware of the tanker traffic coming through and had been very diligent initially in trying to ensure that there was a prevention system in place over the years from the tankers started operating in July of 77, I believe it was. And by 1989, that diligence was no longer being taken seriously by the oil industry, by state Department of Environmental folks who were supposed to be overseeing the oil industry, so we ended up with absolutely no response after the 1989 spill. You know, the good news for us today is that we now do have a very, very good response system in place, but it still doesn't mean that accidents won't happen. We've had some real close calls still in the last 5-6 years a couple of times. The other comment I would just like to bring up is that the herring industry in Prince William Sound has been dramatically curtailed since the oil spill. Since 1997, there hasn't been a commercial herring fishery, and that has tremendous economic impacts on this community as well as a fair number of fishermen around the state.
We're talking about the 15th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato, talking with Jeep Rice, Mary Beth Holloman, and Nancy Bird. Why do you think it hasn't come back? Is it because of the residual oil that's continuing to affect the wildlife?
I believe strongly that it's a combination of the residual oil or the oil impacts on a year class of herring that were in the waters in 1989, and the combination of other natural impacts since then, but it has had a tremendous economic impact, as I say, and to date, Exxon has been unwilling to settle with the commercial fishing industry members on that issue and on the punitive damage issue. So, you know, the continuation of that lawsuit just reverberates through this community every year, and until that lawsuit is finished, it's really hard for people to heal entirely from this event.
They were fined, what, $10 billion? Something like that?
There was a lawsuit, a jury trial in 94 that came out with a $5
billion
punitive damage settlement. The most recent appeal, the federal judge has come back with $4.5 billion is what the number should be, but Exxon is asserting it should only be $25 million. So there's a rather large difference in the numbers.
So you could all get to collect your pensions before you might see any of that money.
Well, actually, what is the number about? Over 1,200 of the plaintiffs have died while they've been waiting. So, yeah.
Wow.
I was down in Bellingham giving a reading, and several fishermen there were in the audience, you know, that have fished the Sound for years. And, you know, one guy said, Buck Malloy said, you know, he's not even counting on it. Maybe his son will get it, maybe not. But it's been 10 years already since the jury verdict.
And Exxon feels that you've already been paid the amount of money that you should get? Is that basically what they're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Jeep Rice, what would happen again today? What kind of response would be different today than happened last time?
Well, there is more equipment in the sound, but, you know, it doesn't matter how prepared you are in a way. Nature can still do its thing. On day three of the spill, there's 60, 70-knot winds came up, and it doesn't matter how long your booms are or how thick they are or how good they are or whatnot. 70-knot winds will not allow you to contain any oil. So if the event were repeated today, there would have been a better response. It has started picking up oil on day one, two, and three, but on day three, everything would have just blown up, and we'd have basically pretty much the same thing.
So it's man against nature again.
Yes, it is. If nature is cooperative, if it's a nice June week in which there are no winds, all the winds are less than 10, 15, 20 knots, you know, a lot of good could happen. But if it's winter, and that's when bad things happen up here in Alaska, is the winter, it could be a repeat.
Do you all think it's just a matter of time before it happens again?
Yeah, I do. Although one thing that could be done, and it is being done, but not quickly enough, is the double hull tankers.
Right.
I think the most recent number I've heard is that 8 of the 22 tankers that come into Valdez are double hulled, only 8 of 22, so we're not even halfway there yet. And they're supposed to all be double hulled by 2015, 11 years from now, but that could happen a lot sooner. I think prevention is really key.
All right, we have to take a quick break. I'm sorry to interrupt. We'll come back and talk lots more with you, take some phone calls. Jeep Rice, Mary Beth Holloman, and Nancy Bird talking about the 15th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note to Monday on Talk of the Nation in this hour. Join Neil Conan and his guests for a discussion on a recent effort to measure the extent of globalization. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about the Exxon Valdez oil spill with my guest, Jeep Rice, program manager of the Exxon Valdez studies at the Auk Bay Laboratory of the National Marine Fisheries Service. Mary Beth Holloman, author of The Heart of the Sound, An Alaskan Paradise Found and Nearly Lost. Nancy Bird, president of the Prince William Sound Science Center. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. When I rudely interrupted, we were talking about preventive measures. One was talking about double-hulled tankers. Any other preventive measures that you might think of that could be used that are not being tried? Or is that basically the best preventive measure?
Well, how about energy conservation?
Oh. you're in my neck of the woods now.
Our nation's energy policy could use some work.
All right.
Another thing, and Nancy can speak to this too, is one of the silver linings was the creation of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. It's funded by the Alyeska, the oil consortium, but it's entirely independent, and it's an incredible citizen watchdog group, and this could be expanded to other places in the country as well. Mm-hmm. And I think part of Open 90 actually said that if it was successful, that would happen.
1-800-989-8255, our number. Evelyn Brown in Fairbanks. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine.
Hi, Jeep and Nancy and everybody else.
You want to tell everybody who you are?
Yes, my name is Evelyn Brown. I was the principal investigator for the damage assessment studies on herring. I was living in Cordova at the time, working for the Department of Fish and Game, and I was married to a fisherman. So
so you were the primary investigator for the herring damage?
Yeah.
And can you give us shed some light maybe on why it still remains so damaged?
Well, I think Jeep touched on it a little bit. It's there's a complex set of interactions that occur, and the oil spill was exposure to the herring happened not just in the first year but over a number of years. Probably from residual oil washing off the beaches, these herring rear in nearshore areas all around the sound and overlap to quite a degree with part of the areas that were oiled. And so the exposure was not a simple thing in one aspect. We strongly believe that it wiped out the 89-year class, and the population took a hit. But then that in combination with natural factors that were affecting the population was just one contributing factor. So it was a contributing factor. And then the question becomes, would the population have crashed to the degree it was without oil? And that becomes almost a risk damage assessment exercise, probability calculation. And most of us believe that, no, it probably would not have. It was a hit that the population was taking when it was probably already in a natural state of decline, and so...
Pushed it over, huh?
Yeah. But there's two things that I would like the panel maybe or you guys to address. Is one thing that, and Jeep and I have talked about this extensively, is that we did not have a scientific response plan that was coordinated across agencies going into the spill. And what that resulted in was a insufficient damage or insufficient documentation of the actual damage that occurred. In other words, there was quite a bit of damage. Plankton, the sand lance, which is an incredibly important forage fish that occurs in thousands of tons and live on those beaches and heavily overlaps where the oil hit. We didn't even look at those species. So there are so many impacts out there that we never even documented because we didn't. And to my knowledge, there is still not in place a coordinated agency response. The only agency that came in there actually prepared to deal with it was probably NOAA because they have this hazmat division. The state agencies were totally ill-prepared.
Uh-huh.
And the second point I'd like these guys to bring up is the cleanup. The cleanup itself had this whole series of secondary impacts.
Right.
And for us as scientists to separate the effects of the cleanup itself, steaming the beaches, resuspension of oil, all that was an impossible. It was nearly impossible job. Mm.
Let me get some reaction. Jeep, you want to react to the first question?
Well, there still isn't a plan. Evelyn is correct in that, and there probably never will be a plan. And it's just the way things go. You know, when a spill happens, where's it at? Who's it affect? What species? And people get together and. And unfortunately, that's the way it goes. There's just no budget, for example, to organize agencies and scientists in a way that would make them ready, so to speak, to respond to a spill. So she's correct that we missed some good data that we should have gathered.
Is there any way to know whether more damage was done in the first few days or in the lingering damage since then?
Well, it's a big question now is what was more damaging, the first year of the spill where you saw carcasses and oil and acute damage, or is the next 14 years, does that add up to the same amount of damage or more or less? And we will never have the data really to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
We can document now that for a few species, not sand lance like Evelyn mentioned, because there was never the upfront studies in the beginning, but for sea otters, we do have a handle, for example, on the lingering damage to them in some places.
Mary Beth, Nancy, any comments?
Yeah. I would comment that I think in contrast to 89 and the aftermath, there would be a lot better communication among the various agency scientists and private universities to other things. The RCAC, Regional Citizens Advisory Council, is a great player in terms of advocating that kind of communication, keeping good lists going. There's a lot better atmosphere than there was in 89. So even though there's not a specific plan in place, I think we would do a lot better job at this point.
The one negative part, though, is that there, with OPA 90, which is the Oil Spill Pollution Act of 1990, which came in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez, it sets up a whole different arrangement, so to speak. And now a spiller, for example, if you want the spiller's cooperation in cleaning up a spill, he actually has to agree to what damage assessments are going to take place. And it's just, I just don't believe that there will ever be a damage assessment or the follow-up studies will never occur. If we were to have an Exxon Valdez spill tomorrow, there just wouldn't be the funding base in order to do those sorts of studies. It just wouldn't happen. Politically, it just wouldn't happen.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Mary Beth Holloman, did you want to say something?
Well, actually, I'm going to ask a question in response to what Evelyn and Jeep and Nancy have said, and that is that given that there was so much that we didn't know and didn't have the science response plan in order to document, but there has been so much science done since in the last 15 years, and now the governments have the opportunity through the 1991 natural resource settlement to go back to Exxon and ask for another $100 million based on unanticipated damages, which from what I've read and seen, it looks like there certainly are unanticipated damages, even just the oil on the beaches that remain 15 years later. So I'm just kind of curious about what folks think about that.
Chief, any reaction?
I think that that we certainly have met the hurdles, so to speak, of identifying more damages than we ever expected. I think getting back actually to an earlier point, was it shocking that there was a spill? To me, I was involved in the damage assessment plan, the environmental impact statement, rather, prior to the spill. And we did predict that there would be a spill sometime in the 30-year life history of the pipeline and that sort of thing. But having said that, that's just something on paper. And then when you go and see what it did and the extent and the volume and the thickness of the oil and the beaches, et cetera, and everywhere, it was shocking. So for the event to happen, it's not shocking. But the impact that it had and then the length of time that it took to recover and the lingering part, that is still shocking.
Hmm.
And so we still... So I think the reopener clause is something that may happen.
So from what I hear all of you saying, we're really in no better position now to prevent that from happening again, to know the science about what the impact would be, or to clean it up in 15 years.
Well, we are smarter than we were then. We did learn an awful lot.
Well, what would you learn that would prevent it from happening again?
Well, we have a lot of systems in place that should prevent the kind of Exxon Valdez type event, catastrophic event, from happening. There have been a couple of close calls, but they've so far, with the tractor tug systems that are in place, thanks to RCAC's pushing for them and such, there are preventive measures in place a lot and response. If weather were to come up, as Jeep said earlier, we could still face an Exxon Valdez type event, but I think we've reduced the risk dramatically to that happening.
We're talking about the Exxon Valdez oil spill anniversary this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me see if I can get a phone call or two in here before we have to go. Let's head out to Los Gatos. Tom, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, excellent show, and thanks for taking my call. It's been fabulous. We feel the pain of the Alaskans here in Silicon Valley. We have the highest concentration of Superfund cleanups anywhere in the country. Our groundwater, surface water, including San Francisco Bay, are all so polluted with mercury and solvents that we can't even eat the fish in the freshwater streams that feed into the bay or from the bay itself. But we're washed with alcohol here, and it clouds the minds of our civic people here. I was wondering, is there a zero-tolerance policy now for alcohol amongst mariners in the Alaskan waters, whether they're civilian or military, including the Coast Guard? Because it seems like alcohol had a lot to do with the Exxon Valdez disaster.
Yeah, well, do captains get tested regularly, or is there what happens there? Jeep, do you know?
Yes.
Nancy, take this one.
Nancy, go ahead. Nancy Bird?
yes, captains get tested regularly. There has been a dramatic change since 1989 on that point.
Whatever happened to Captain Hazelwood?
Well, he never apologized.
We don't know. Let's go to the phones. I think Pete in Baltimore. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi.
My understanding, in answer to your question, my understanding is that Captain Hazelwood is now driving supertankers.
You think he's still driving supertankers?
Yes, they took him off for a while and they put him back on. And the reason why is because there are exceptionally few captains who are qualified by the current qualification standards to captain supertankers.
Hmm. Okay.
And that's meant to use that to say this is something that. I think it's a big piece of the puzzle for preventing future Exxon Valdez events is that the training and qualifications, I think, need to change.
All right. Thanks for calling. Let's see if I can get one more call in here. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Elizabeth in Kasiloff, Alaska. Hi, Elizabeth. Quickly.
Hello. It's Kasiloff.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. And I believe of all the companies that ship oil from Valdez, that Exxon is the only one that does not have any double-hulled tankers at this time, and I'd like to know if that's true.
That's my understanding as well.
And it's also It's also interesting that Exxon resisted heavily any ballast water regulations, whereas other oil companies readily agreed to some kind of mitigation of the ballast water problems. And the agreement that Exxon made with the state about, I believe they don't have to release any of their scientific information from any of the studies that they did after the spill. I don't believe that they're required to release those.
All right, we're going to have to say goodbye because we've run out of time. I would like to thank all of my guests, Chief Rice, Program Manager of Exxon Valdez Studies at the Auk Bay Laboratory of the National Marine Fisheries Service, that's part of NOAA, based in Juneau, Mary Beth Holloman, author of The Heart of the Sound, An Alaskan Paradise Found and Nearly Lost, just out from the University of Utah Press, and Nancy Bird, president of the Prince William Sound Science Center and director of the Oil Spill Recovery Institute in Cordova, Alaska. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Charles Berquist, Erica Altman, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is also our director and our web producer. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vint. If you want to write, send us to go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Surf over there. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. We have curricula, free curricula that we make based on our programming. Also, you can download editions of Science Friday on your Audible player and also leave us email at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.